listeners to Sounding Out's podcast series, an oral chronicle of sound and culture. Sounding Out remixes the everyday with theory, insight, and practice. To learn more, please visit us on the web at www.soundstudiesblog.com. Until then, stay tuned for today's episode.
Just leave it down there.
Put it on the stool.
No, it's gonna fall again.
No, it's not. Because it's near us.
But if I move like this, which I might be doing,
you will not pull it like that.
See, it's closer to us.
I like the art room because you do art. And Mr. Duff on both of these ones. And my seat is right here. And this where Mr. Duff sits.
This is the cafetorium, and I love the cafetorium because it is fun in here. Because I love this place because it looks fun. Period.
Circles. Put your finger on the one you would like to
I
go to.
I love the board, and I love the lockers.
How many put your finger on the first?
Because the lockers.
The second one.
Is amazing. And I love the trash can where he will live in. And
hands down, please.
Because he's very funny.
Let's listen and see what they say.
Ha ha ha.
Let's listen.
Oh. No, no, Mr. Bennett.
Statue of Liberty.
We have again arrived at a moment where the rubber meets the road, when realpolitik presses the complexities of our metaphors and the depth of understandings into rather limited choices. To do or not to do. How to engage if we do, how to disengage if we do not. Where ongoing injustices and the everyday practices that breathe into those fires of violence and oppression run hot. Hot enough to burn through previous layers of prophylactic privilege. Times where people new to the heat reach for clunky claims that further incite those whose lived selves are regularly battered by social cultural norms and values that insist on their oppression precisely so that others might live on in ways that they find normal and comfortable. A moment in which those notions of capital and privilege are switching poles in ways that can trigger deep retrenchment for those who finally have a tiny taste of the violences of oppressions that they themselves continue to reproduce. Like the old joke of a man who goes to the doctor complaining that his arm hurts too much when he waves it around in a rather unnatural way. So don't do that, the doctor girlly replies. So long in their favor that others are blamed for the very histories and current practices that fomented their unjustified privileges and proclivities. Conversely, it's a moment where the juvenile nature of our most democratic modes of communication, adults upset that someone they've never met no longer, quote, likes them, or statements in 250-word increments, more often lauded for their cutting nature and ad hominem attacks, lend themselves to a kind of oppression sweepstakes, where oppressed peoples are not given enough room to speak because they are not properly oppressed enough. where solidarities are less valued than our ability to dominate another, while arguing that the dominator deserves the right to oppress, without recognizing that it is the very mode of oppression that they themselves still fight, as if oppression is less dangerous or harmful to the oppressor when polarities have inverted, as if somehow it is not an all-hands-on-deck moment. These, however, are not new, nor are they the focus of this work, but instead serve as the backdrop for this piece. Situated somewhere between a podcast and an academic argument, it is a piece of something that might be called sounded scholarship, the consideration and expression of understandings gained through research processes and presented through the sonic. As such, it's a work that would not be possible in text and function rather differently as video-oriented media. Black Sound Studies is at once new and always already new, a burgeoning field of study and long-standing traditions in attention to sound, society, culture, ecologies, and blackness. As I've argued elsewhere about the sensuous and sound in education, what is new is beyond the coalescing of once disparate understandings into a transdisciplinary field called sound studies, that foreground sound as theoretical and practical trajectories for argument and study, is the development of a distinct yet overlapping field called black sound studies. Examples of what Alexander Wahalyeh calls sonic Afro-modernity and Afro-phonologies tend to be expressly connected to Du Bois, due to his particular combination of attention to blackness, his sounds and articulations, the lyricism in his talk and writing, and the depth and complexity of his theoretical and practical arguments in both text and speech. Such attention to Du Bois tends to focus on the possibilities for sound and sensibilities in his seminal work, Souls of Black Folk, and rightly so, for central to the mix, like DJs and Hepcats, is Du Bois' emphasis on the political and the aesthetic. Grounded in Du Bois' talk now called Criteria for Negro Art, we linger a bit here today on a particular aspect of the affectively ontological, black joy. This particular take is also indebted to Sylvia Winter's complex interweaving of pathways to the affective through the everyday, work on entangled trajectories of justice, feminism, and blackness that builds on Winter's scholarship. Edouard Glissant's similar yet distinct arguments for complexly entangled political poetics in relation, and the pain and possibility of Fred Moten's aesthetic break and the blurring of sonic blackness. Along similar lines, black joy is central to both Afro-pessimist and Afro-futurist perspectives, where the former can be understood as the impossibility of a black futurity from current trajectories of blackness beyond ongoing patterns of oppression and violence. The latter is often presented as the altering and amplifying of particular pathways of blackness that currently exist towards a rather similar goal. Yet both hold fast the potential and significance of anything that might be conceptualized as black joy. In June 1926, later published in The Crisis of October the same year, W.E.B. Du Bois delivered a keynote to the NAACP that, in many ways, shocked a crowd that came to hear about critical politics, with its intentionally aesthetic bent, a work that has come to be known as Criteria for Negro Art. And it is right here, Du Bois states, that the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People comes upon the field, comes with its great call to a new battle, a new fight, and new things to fight before the old things are wholly won, and to say that the beauty of truth and freedom, which shall someday be our heritage and the heritage of all civilized men, is not in our hands yet, and that we ourselves must not fail to realize. Anachronistic language momentarily aside, Du Bois asks of his audience, how can we talk about who we are without endless opportunities to articulate those expressions in any manner we desire? Thus, all art is propaganda and ever must be, despite the wailing of the purists. I stand in utter shamelessness and say that whatever art I have for writing has been used always for propaganda, for gaining the right of black folk to love and enjoy. I do not care a damn for any art that is not used for propaganda. But I do care when propaganda is confined to one side, while the other is stripped and silent. Criteria for Negro Art, paragraph 29. Take the sheet off your face, it's a brand new day, the Staple Singers tell us. Respect yourself. Art is always political, even when its makers insist that it isn't. There is always a choice of this over that, idea rather than idea, process rather than process, media rather than media. move rather than move, expression rather than expression. And who is to say what is and is not? That's where the power lies, Du Bois tells us. For how can there be a black future without a black imaginary? Without Billy Strayhorn, would we have two turntables and a microphone? On it goes, backwards and forwards, across time and immeasurable distances, even when they are but a few feet down a corridor. As a person, I tend to move towards the critical, the uncovering of injustices through study that so often gets swept under the rug. The elite nudges of oppression and the little everyday aggressions and the big systemic choices that allow those in power to claim them as common sense, while reconstructing systems, places, and spaces that oppress as much through their inclusion as their exclusion. That education is the site of these considerations, and schools so often the vehicle, means I spend a great deal of time in critical scholarly spaces and thinking with young people about their daily lives. And there is a distance, a space of significance between young people and schools and critical scholarship. Where the former has joy, even when it springs up for a second like a flower that blooms every few years when the conditions are just right, the latter tends to focus on the heavy oppression and aggression. As, quite frankly, it should. We who have the time and the tools and the privilege must call into the light systemic, institutional, and interpersonal injustices that have been clear since Anna Julia Cooper and beyond. The joy, though. Joy moves the marker. Joy that is full in its blackness, infinitely varied and complex, without need for comparison, for validation in any direction on its own terms. It's joy. Giggles to snorts, guffaws, and bellows. Twinkle in an eye, twitch of the shoulder, trying not to smile, beaming, a lighter step, head high or crouch down, that internal haptic liminality sparking for the briefest of moments that pops up again throughout a day, resonating at the same frequency, spreads, little bit sprinkled, crashing like a waterfall. Waterfalls of song, say Stephen Feld in TLC. Joy. The face of nonsense is a political act for the ages, even if it's just your age at that time. There is a joy in quietude, a dignity in sovereignty, the internal reverberations, resonating with that thing you thought, holding it tight, smiling on the inside, not in hiding, but in the joy of the joy and holding it fast. Refusal to give in to the nonsense, finding something even or especially when it is pressed, for pressing is often a key to oppression. It is, as often said in debates, political and otherwise, a refusal or rejection of the premise. While the question might be fine, its foundations are rotten, and to answer the question, even while pointing to the disease at its base, is in some fashion to concede, to agree to work with fruit from yet another poison tree. It is joy in refusal, and through which joy remains political, as much an expression of pleasure as it is a statement of knowledges, and against oppression and aggression, even, or, again, perhaps especially, when well-intentioned. There is also a kind of joy that is syncretic, appearing to celebrate one thing when it in fact the celebration of another, or joy that infuriates opposition and dominance. Not a false joy, though the manufacturing of joy in the response to oppression as an expression of refusal sometimes also has this flavor. Sometimes, though, joy can be mistaken for agreement, or idiocy, or ignorance. But then there's what we say and do to young people. Teach them the importance of being serious. Equate seriousness with thought. Suggest that joy comes from spending time with things that are not necessarily pleasant. Not that this is wholly incorrect, or somehow young people don't need guidance, or to better hear others' feelings, or attend to contexts. They're people, and just learning to do some things. We all know adults who can't keep it together. I, for example, can't sit with some during important meetings or those where I know I'll disagree because of the likelihood of upcoming ruckus. Not that I won't hear or can't be an adult, but that there is a thing where I know I'm going to talk some shit to get through whatever it is, and those who believe in it are going to be taking it seriously. This is what I mean by removing joy from our lives. And whispers are why is it kindergartners can all sing, dance, and I know I'm going to be fighting it somewhere else. So and by third grade, over the past 40 years, language has developed these very same things.
and in critical
and
studies
and now
of
there's
school,
testing of all kinds
conceptualizing
of
conceptualizing how marginalized
because how can
and
we know of the garden of children is growing differences without measuring from the shit out of it.
Sociocultural
maybe they too can have their joy appropriately squelched and be proper
further,
students.
These are behavioral differences often regarded
we should be
as
much,
cognitive
much
deficits.
More ashamed of ourselves.
Practically, this means that poor to working class students of color, for example, are much more likely to have their behaviors marked as problematic, and those manufactured problems translated into cognitive concerns. The results of such tendencies are everywhere. Black boys are more likely to be suspended from preschool, than their Anglo peers. Dropout rates are highest among young men of color, and a correspondingly large uptick in incarcerated youth of color happens at approximately the same age as the consent to drop out. In short, Black girls and boys are much more likely to have their ontological differences considered as cognitive deficits. As but one example, as part of a study conducted in a technology lab space designed for observation, I happened to be present one day when students were taking a written assessment as part of another study with a different class. I was early, and multiple classes utilized this space in a given week. The class of approximately 25 third graders was overwhelmingly Anglo. There was but a single Black child in the class. She finished her assignment first, then quietly put her head down, which was her choice, to wait for her peers to finish as her teacher had previously instructed. Moments later, the teacher's aide, an Anglo woman in her 40s, walked over and insisted that she start getting to work. When the student started to reply that she had, the aide quickly shut her down in a louder voice. Some version of this happened a couple more times, and each time the student again put her head down, once slipping her thumb in her mouth for a bit of comfort. On the fourth pass, a researcher, in her early 30s and also Anglo, came by and more kindly but nevertheless insistently, yet again asked the student if she was finished with her work. Finally, on what is at least the five or sixth pass, the researcher came by one more time and asked the student if she was finished, at which point the student promptly showed the researcher her finished work. When it came time to check their answers, this resilient girl's hand shot up high and, with a smile when called on, answered correctly. She had gotten 9 out of 10 answers correct and been the first person done. In yet another layer of showing how differences can be recast as deficits, I too was policed, disallowed to comment or help by explicit request of the staff to whom I had pointed out what was happening. It would break protocol, they said. Even though my actions would have nothing to do with the study, the girl was already finished, and there was nothing left for her to do in that particular exercise. Both staff members were former teachers in their middle to late 60s and Anglo. These are behavior differences, recast as cognitive deficits. Joy in classrooms is behavioral. Educational literatures tend to focus on ways of speaking, of moving, and the like, as the kinds of behaviors that are negatively policed in schools. While significant, discussions of joy are often out of the scope of scholarly attention. Joy that happens during classroom lessons is often categorized as forms of off-task behavior, interactions and actions that I argue essentially mean doing anything other than what the teacher had in mind, regardless of what she has said or done. Black joy is indeed ontologically its own complex, significant experience. It is also affectively different than how joy is to be expressed in schools, understandings that are closely aligned to Anglo ways of being, knowing, doing. In schools, Black joy is often a behavioral difference recast as an indicator of cognitive deficit. Furthermore, in an extension of arguments about how sounds are utilized to articulate the reification of socioculturally constructed notions of race, schools sound white. This is in part a product of majority white teaching population that continues in spite of a national collective majority of students of color in grades 4 and below, a national student body that will remain an Anglo minority ever after. It is also because, as with the textbooks students use in how systems function to create American schooling, schools intentionally sound white. In schools with majority Black students, a curious thing often happens. Where classrooms sound Anglo, corridors sound Black. Black joy bursts into the hallways and is suppressed in classrooms. As sounds form educational spaces, physical boundaries with joy seeping through, the cement or plywood or sheetrock or tile, carrying joy faster and more efficiently than the air. Schools, like the societies that produce them, are sonically anti-Black institutions. As I recently wrote in a book on sound and education, should this somehow be in doubt, please remember that Jordan Davis, a 17-year-old African-American high school student, was murdered by Michael Dunn, a 47-year-old Anglo software developer, because of what Dunn called, quote, loud music. Jordan Davis was killed for playing Black music at too Black a volume while being a Black teen. All of this in addition to long-standing traditions of settler colonialisms and, as Woodson argued and others have reiterated,
I do care
there could be no metaphorical or literal lynching without it starting in the schoolhouse. But you can't squelch joy. You can try, but no. Like a suppressed giggle that snorts its way out, the escaping sonic exclamation, the catalyst for belly-aching laughter, it slips through, pushes, moves out of the cracks and into educational colleges. Listen, there's joy. As Mike Jassar argues in The Sound of Black Laughter, the Harlem Renaissance, Rod McKay, Sterling Brown, Langston Hughes, a work that also name-checks Du Bois in its first sentence, there is a history of joy expressed as laughter, especially in the work of Black poets. It begins with the opening lines of Langston Hughes' Laughers. Dream singers, storytellers, dancers, loud laughers in the hands of fate, my people. It is a poem that ends, dancers and laughers. Laughers, yes, laughers. Laughers, laughers. Loudmouth laughers in the hands of fate. Faithful joy, Black joy. The sounds of Black joy at school. An unstoppable counter-narrative of possibility, grinning in the face of sonic whiteness.
To know about winter solstice. It starts on December 21st. It's the shortest day because the earth is tilted from the sun. Do you want to know about winter solstice? It starts on December 21st. It's the shortest day because the earth is tilted from the sun.
Yeah.